Hello, welcome to Book Therapy. This is episode 8. I am Rob Cohen. As usual, you can find me on Twitter at RobCohen13. You can also find me on iTunes. Book Therapy is the name of the podcast. And the Book Therapy website at www.booktherapy.podbean.com. Plus, I have a blog website at RobCohen13.com. So that's all the information. Get that out of the way. Now let's get on to some business. I think when we left off, I was in the middle of reading the Sherlock Holmes mystery House of Silk, which was written by Anthony Horowitz and happened to be one of the few, I don't know if there were any other, Sherlock Holmes mysteries that was actually approved by the Arthur Conan Doyle estate or Arthur Conan Doyle Society or the family of Arthur Conan Doyle or something like that. But anyways, House of Silk, I was about halfway through it when we last spoke, and obviously I had a chance to finish the book. My impressions of the book are really not terribly dissimilar from what I talked about earlier. At the time, I was at a place in the book where Sherlock Holmes had been sent away. He'd actually been arrested for murder, and while he was in jail, we had the opportunity to see a little bit more of Dr. Watson acting on his own. I had hoped that Dr. Watson might further the mystery discovery a little bit, might actually undertake some more investigations on his own, but alas, that really isn't what happened. He maintained his status of being merely not much of a trailblazer as far as the discovery and investigations went. He did have an interesting interaction with a shady bit of character who we later find out was possibly Holmes's arch nemesis, Professor Moriarty. But at the end of the day, it still was a Sherlock Holmes novel. It was still a Sherlock Holmes mystery, and Sherlock Holmes was the hero who saved the day. And in his inimitable fashion, he was able to summarize the entire mystery, bringing the two potentially unrelated or seemingly unrelated mysteries together, and bringing us back to the place where it all started, the identity of the killer, the identity of the thief, and in a way that is purely Sherlock Holmes, with his powers of deduction that are really unmatched, but also are not available to the reader. Again, as I mentioned in other episodes, there is a distancing of the reader from the mystery when the reader is not permitted to see everything that the investigator gets to see. And that is always the case with the Sherlock Holmes mystery, because Sherlock Holmes is not our narrator. Dr. Watson is our narrator, and we are limited by whatever Dr. Watson is permitted to perceive on his own. And as Sherlock Holmes is wont to make mention of, Dr. Watson's skills of deduction are far inferior to Sherlock Holmes himself. So we only learn, as Dr. Watson learns, what information Sherlock Holmes relies on to deduce the resolution of the crime. In this instance, I felt it was a little bit unfair because being a reader, you have to imagine certain situations, you have to imagine certain characters. And I don't know about how you read, but when I read, the characters, unless they're specifically described as having identifiable features, they're really pretty amorphous in my imagination. They don't really have well-defined faces or well-defined body types, unless that's something that's specifically instructed by the author. So in this situation, when we find out that there were actually twins that were involved, but the twins were in fact, we knew they were twins earlier, but when we find out that the twins were male-female twins, it's really not something that we could have been able to glean on our own as a reader, because we can't perceive the characters. We don't see them. We can't denote facial similarities or body type similarities or anything like that. And in all fairness, Dr. Watson does mislead the reader, because when he says that they're twins, he either, and I don't remember specifically if he informed the reader that they were same-sex twins, if they were male twins, or if the reader simply draws that conclusion on his own, because when Sherlock Holmes comes later and informs everybody that the twins were boy-girl twins, it's certainly a bit of a surprise. So what I've always marveled at from the standpoint of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries is not really the mystery themselves, the chase, so to speak, that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go on is really not particularly thrilling. But the crafting of the mystery and the powers of deduction that Sherlock Holmes is able to show off, the minutiae of details that Sherlock Holmes is able to decipher from what seem to be usually ordinary situations, or at least ordinary crime scenes, to the extent that there can be an ordinary crime scene, the real fascination with the Sherlock Holmes character is the way that even Arthur Conan Doyle was able to craft these resolutions to a point where they are wholly satisfying to the reader. Although, if you're a reader that's like me, you do feel a little bit cheated by not being permitted to participate in the discovery process. You feel like you do because you are actually sitting there with Dr. Watson, and Dr. Watson stays with Sherlock Holmes most of the time throughout the course of the investigation. But because Sherlock Holmes does not let Watson in on his thought processes all too often, we tend to learn of the resolution at the same time Dr. Watson learns of it, and he is, in a lot of circumstances, just as surprised as the reader is. So in reading a Sherlock Holmes story or a novel, it's really important to take note of the fact that it's not going to be a rip-roaring adventure like you would be used to with a Michael Connelly or a Robert Craze or a Jonathan Kellerman, that you're really going to be limited by Dr. Watson's abilities to describe situations and describe scenarios, and then also limited by the fact that Sherlock Holmes does not really let Watson in on the discovery process. He keeps it all internal. The other thing that I thought was particularly interesting about this book is I don't remember in a lot of the previous Sherlock Holmes casework that I've read, Sherlock Holmes taking a particularly personal type of an interest in a matter. Sure, he may take on a matter because he finds it intriguing or feels that there's a chase to be taken, or a chase to be pursued, but I don't recall when the matter has been resolved that Sherlock Holmes provides any type of close connection to the mystery where he feels that justice has been served, or that he really has done his duty to a victim in that respect. Here, we definitely felt that. There was a little boy who was killed. I think Sherlock Holmes felt some responsibility for it because he believed that he had put the young boy into the line of fire and that it was his responsibility to find the killer. We later find out that Sherlock Holmes may not have had anything really to do with that, but there was a point where Sherlock Holmes felt a close connection to the little boy who had been killed and felt that there had been a tragedy. And I don't remember that same measure of humanity in a lot of the other Sherlock Holmes stories. So to see it in this story was a little bit refreshing because as a reader, you get wrapped up in the characters, but you also get wrapped up in the victims. And in not giving away some of the secrets of this book, the way that the children specifically were treated was particularly nasty and uncomfortable, and the reader could develop a sensitivity to the kids, a connection to them, an anger on their behalf, and to see Sherlock Holmes also exhibit those same types of feelings was comforting, and I felt that the end of the book gave me that level of comfort with Sherlock Holmes as a character, that he's not just a two-dimensional automaton who solves a case and then goes on to the next one or goes back to studying, vermicelli or, smoking his cocaine or whatever it was, that this was actually a human Sherlock Holmes who felt some true sadness for the mystery as it unraveled, for the victims of the crime. And actually, we believe, Watson does not come straight out to inform us, but we're certainly led to believe, that Holmes actually took some action against the culprits after the mystery had been resolved and the quote-unquote bad guys had been caught. So that was refreshing. It was comforting. There was a warmth to that I don't really recall in a lot of the previous Holmes stories that I've read. Again, going back, when I read the first volume of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, I read them all, 1,000 pages or whatever it was. I read it kind of like a novel, so I read them back to back to back to back to back, and you can't separate the stories out. It's difficult to identify one story from the next, and I think I did myself a disservice in reading it in that fashion, because I read it more like a casual reader as opposed to somebody who was attempting to study the canon. And if I were trying to study it, well, then it's a different type of reading altogether. You've got, you know, the process would be potentially taking notes, really reading and rereading and then rereading again just to make sure that you understood all of the deductions that Sherlock Holmes had made. When I read a mystery, yes, I enjoy the chase. I enjoy the process of discovery. But to me, it is about getting to the end. It is about discovering who the bad guy was, or bad girl. I don't mean to be sexist. And so in reading a Sherlock Holmes novel and focusing more on the discovery at the end, you lose sight of maybe some of the clues that were available to you previously in the story, that Watson figured out how to nestle into the story, but which I had overlooked. So reading them in a truly linear fashion could be could have done myself a disservice. So as I get to read maybe the second volume of the Sherlock Holmes canon, I might decide to take them one at a time and separate the stories out, not to read it in such a linear fashion. So that was The House of Silk. On Goodreads, I think I gave it 3 stars, probably a 3.5 out of 5. Enjoyable. I think that the issues that I had with the book were the same issues that I would have with any Sherlock Holmes novel. But understanding that that's what you're going to get in a Sherlock Holmes book, for the future, should I read more Sherlock Holmes books, I will be much more aware of what to expect for that reading experience. So after I concluded the Sherlock Holmes book, I felt that I was not quite as comforted. I didn't get the reading experience that I wanted, and I was looking still, like I mentioned before, for some sort of what I guess would be a gothic mystery, something that would be dark, something that would be Jack the Ripper styled, something that would envelop my senses through the reading experience. So I decided that I was going to pick up a book called The Truth of All Things by Kieran Shields, and it was his first novel. And what attracted me to the book, I found it on Amazon, was that it takes place in New England, in Maine, Portland, Maine, in 1897, I think it is. In the 1890s. And, I'm sorry, 1892. And what's interesting is it involves, from the back of the book, it involves the killing of a prostitute who, after she's killed, the body is laid out in the shape of a pentagram, pinned to the earth with a pitchfork, and that we learn that this is that, as the book describes, that the that this method of death is a traditional method of killing a witch. So to that, it felt like this might be, you know, a truly great entry into this author, but would also encompass a lot of the themes and storylines that I was looking for. And unfortunately, I wasn't quite as satisfied with the book as I had hoped. In fact, what I really got was another Sherlock Holmes novel. Not that the character was Sherlock Holmes per se, but one of the characters, name of Percival Gray, exhibited so many of the same characteristics of Sherlock Holmes that it was easy to forget that this was not a Sherlock Holmes novel. For instance, this character of Percy Gray was a master of disguise. He was a master of deduction. He went through some sort of a deduction example, or he gave a deduction example, I guess is the best word to use, when he was introduced to the inspector who was investigating the murder. And it's really interesting because there's a scene where one of the characters goes into a bar. The main character inspector, his name is Archie Lean, L-E-A-N. When Archie goes into a bar to interview a potential suspect, but not really a suspect, a witness. He walks out and finds out that one of the patrons of the bar was Percival Gray, who had been there in disguise, you know, dressed up like another, you know, 1890s drunk bar, you know, barkeep, a bar visitor, whatever you want to call it. Later on, Archie goes to visit an opium den, and it turns out that, again, Percival Gray had been there as one of the opium den, you know, visitors, and little did Archie know that Percival Gray was there the whole time. So this was pretty much a Sherlock Holmes novel. And the problem is that the book jacket itself gives away too much of the story. And the first 100 pages were so slow because you're waiting to get to the part where they make the connection that this has to do with witchcraft. Because that's really the part of the story that draws the reader in from the standpoint of the description of the book on the back of the book. That it's this idea that there's a witches involved in the Salem witch trials from 200 years previous. And that's really where the excitement of the chase comes in. But it takes 100 pages to get there. And for that 100 pages, while things are moving so slow, you're sitting there saying, okay, get there already. It has to do with witchcraft. Get past that story. Get past that issue of what does this all mean? And start with the witchcraft and move from there. And, you know, I've heard that there's people out there who don't like to read the book jackets before they start a book. And that's great if you're being assigned a book. If you have to read a book to write a review, or you're in school and you have to read a book, or you're in a book group and you have to read a book, where you don't really have a choice, that's fine. Don't read the book jacket. Don't read about the book. Don't get some sort of a preconceived idea of what the book's about. That's fine. And you'll be plenty surprised whatever happens. I don't read that way. I don't have to read any of these books. And so the only way I'll know whether I want to read a book or not is I have to read the description of the book. I mean, it makes sense. And so when you read a book like this, and you read the back in the first paragraph, or less than a paragraph, two sentences of the book jacket description, you learn about this ritual killing of prostitutes and the way that you kill a witch. And I mean, that all sounds really, really interesting, but it takes the main characters too damn long to get there. And then once you get there, it's just a slow pacing to get to the end. I got to about 100 or 150 pages in, and I really started to question whether I wanted to even read anymore, because it wasn't moving fast enough. The characters weren't going through the process of discovery rapidly enough where it was keeping my interest. And then it got exciting, and it was exciting for about 20 pages, and then it slowed down again. So this book really had some issues with its pacing, because it would be real slow. Real slow. Something really exciting, some really great discovery, or there was another murder, or one of the characters is being stalked and she's being followed through the library, and then it would slow down, and then it would slow down, and so that pacing was really frustrating, because I was waiting for the book to become more enrapturing. I was waiting for the book to become the page turner that I really wanted it to be. And it just didn't quite get there. And then by the time the book got to its denouement, to its conclusion, I really didn't care. And not only did I not care, but there were so many different characters that came and went through the course of the investigation that it got to be confusing. And I remember I had to go back a couple of times to figure out who these characters were, because I wasn't sure how they interrelated. I wasn't sure what the connections between them were. And I really wasn't sure at the end of the story who the culprit was or why he did what he did. And so from that standpoint, it really felt like a missed opportunity. There were some interesting parts. There was a part involving a seance with a medium, and Percival Gray really didn't participate in the seance because he didn't believe it existed. He didn't believe that it was a valid. He felt it was all a sham. It was all magic stuff and not legitimate. But in a true Sherlock Holmes novel, anything that would be perceived to be not real, or would perceive to be mythic or mystical. Sherlock Holmes, I think, if I recall correctly, does everything he can to debunk the myth, so that it's kind of like pulling away the curtain so you can see the man behind the curtain who's pulling the strings and making the table levitate off the ground and all that kind of stuff. So in the Sherlock Holmes books, my perception of it is he finds a way to dispel any notions that witchcraft or wizardry or magic is real. I think in one of the Sherlock Holmes books I read, called The Italian Secretary by Caleb Carr, who I'll get to him in a second, it involved ghosts and things like that. And if I recall correctly, similar to the way, you know, Scooby-Doo would find out the true culprit, he pulls off the mask and you find out that it wasn't really a ghost at all. But in this one, in The Truth of All Things, they don't do anything to debunk the myth. And so I found that a little bit discomforting, because I am a bit of a scaredy cat. So there were parts of the book which felt a little bit more creepy than I was comfortable with. And then when Percival Gray didn't come to the rescue and pull back the curtain and expose the seance mistress as the fraud that she was, it felt a little bit uncomfortable. Another aspect of the book that I felt was really, really slowed the process down. There are books which I won't read, or subject matters that I will stay away from, because to me they are simply not interesting enough. Those are books that involve Native Americans, Indians, anything that has to take place in the desert, or cowboys, anything that takes place in extreme cold. Those to me are situations that they're storylines that, for whatever reason, they just don't interest me enough to the point where the story is really a page turner. One of the books that I resisted reading for a while, I knew I was going to read it, but I just decided I was going to put it off for a while, was a book called 61 Hours by Lee Child. It was in the Jack Reacher series, and it took place in, I think, North Dakota or something like that. And it took place in the middle of winter where it was, you know, 20 below. And having all that information ahead of time based on what the book jacket said, I just felt that it was going to be a book that would be too slow for me to read. It was just going to drag. It was a setting that I did not feel would be exciting enough for me. And for 61 hours, when I did finally read it, I loved it. I thought that the book was fantastic, and was kind of disappointed in myself that I waited as long as I did to read it. But in The Truth of All Things, within that first 100 pages that I mentioned as being real slow, there's a sub-story about this Indian tribe called the Abenakis, which was indicative of upstate Maine. I don't know if indicative is the right word. But anyways, was found in upstate Maine. Because the way that the killing took place, there was the killer had written some words in, I think, blood at the crime scene that was in this Abenaki language, and so there was a belief that some member of the Abenaki tribe was behind the killing. So, and it turned out that Percival Gray is half Abenaki Indian. But so within those first 100 pages, Percival Gray and Archie Lean go to visit the Abenaki Indians. The Indians, by that point, the tribe had pretty much been westernized, and so all that we saw was what it seems to me was like a traveling show of Abenaki tribe members who tried to recreate the Abenaki tribe heritage, so to speak. But it just slowed things down, and it was like, no, okay, get it. We know it's not this. We know it has to do with witchcraft. We know it's not an Indian ritual thing. We know that it's a red herring, or it's designed to drive you off the path. Go back to the witchcraft. Go back to that. Let's talk more about that. And so it that just slowed things down, and it was like, oh, get to it already. Just get to it. And as I'm reading the book and they do start to delve more into the witchcraft, you get a little bit more of the Salem witch trials. And I'm trying to remember as I'm reading this book about the Arthur Miller play, The Crucible, and we see that some of the same names, and I don't remember that at all, because as I'm reading that, I'm thinking about how The Crucible was written by Arthur Miller as, in order to expose the, the communist, the Joseph McCarthy witch hunt, investigations into communism and the blacklist and all that kind of stuff. So as I'm reading about the Salem witch trials, my mind is starting to wander and I'm losing stuff and it's getting slow, and then something fast would happen and I'd get a little bit more inspiration to really sit down and read. But this was a book where I would look at it and say, well, do I want to read another chapter? No, I'll pick it up another time. So I had to actually sit down and force myself to read. And I can do a good 100 pages in a sitting, but I really had to force myself to read, read the book and get through it. And I felt bad not finishing it. I felt like I owed it to myself to read it. And I'm not really one to push through a book if I'm not enjoying it. There's plenty of other books out there. If I don't like it, I'll find something else to read. And I actually have, I think, put down one or two books this year already. But I pushed through it. I'm glad I did. It was interesting enough. One of the things that I felt was interesting about the book was its connection to the character I already mentioned, Caleb. I'm not the character, the author I already mentioned by the name of Caleb Carr. I think that there are some reviews of the book that mentioned a close kinship with a Caleb Carr book. Caleb Carr is an author who I first read about 15 or 20 years ago, I guess. It's got to have been that long, in the early 90s. And he wrote a book called The Alienist, and then he wrote a second book called The Angel of Darkness. And those two books involved a character by the name of Laszlo Krieger, I think is what it was. He was a doctor. I think he was a psychologist. And actually, he was one of the three main characters of the book, but it involved investigations in New York around the turn of the century. And I think that might be, those two books may be where I really started to develop that interest in that type of a novel. Unfortunately, after The Angel of Darkness came out, which was a sequel to The Alienist, Caleb Carr did not come out with any other books that were akin to those two. He did write the Sherlock Holmes book, The Italian Secretary. And then he wrote a couple of other books which had nothing to do with mystery, had nothing to do with that time period. And so I didn't read them. And, I think since then I've been waiting to hear that Caleb Carr had written something else that was going back to his roots of The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness. I don't remember the stories very well. I remember it was three main characters, two men and a woman. I think that both The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness involved children, whether it was murders or kidnappings or things, violence against children. But I remember that I really, really enjoyed them. The Alienist, I think I found a little bit complex. At the time I read it, I think I was too young to read it. I don't know that I'll go back and read it again because I don't reread books. But The Angel of Darkness, I remember having in hardcover. And I think I remember being blown away by it. I think it was really, really engaging. And I've tried to find books that mimic that style for a long time and haven't really been able to find what I was looking for. And I thought that I'd found it in The Truth of All Things. But unfortunately, I didn't. So anyways, that was The Truth of All Things. Actually, you know what? There was one other thing I wanted to mention. when the villain, when the bad guy is finally getting his comeuppance at the end, and Percival Gray and Archie Lean have tracked him down, he said something which I thought was interesting compared with our earlier discussion of the Da Vinci Code. And if you remember the episode of The Da Vinci Code, I talked about the roots of Christianity and where I've always had questions about where Christianity came from. And there was a discussion in The Da Vinci Code about the Council of whatever it was called, some weird word, that basically put together the Bible. And so there was a passage when the bad guy is kind of explaining what his motives were in committing the killings that he did. He says this, so Percival Gray says, he says, "You realize, of course, that you're a lunatic. To believe in witchcraft and all this, it's madness." And the bad guy says, "Madness? Consider this, Gray. if you speak a few lines to her, he was talking to the woman, tomorrow she tells them to a friend who relays them to me. Next week, I repeat them back to you. Probably half the words are changed. Would you wager $5, let alone your eternal soul, on how well those words were kept in just 1 week? So he's talking about basically the game of telephone. Each time you tell somebody, and each person down the line hears it differently, and it changes its content. So he says, how well would you be willing to wager $5, let alone your eternal soul, on how well those words were kept in just 1 week? Yet you worship a God nailed to a post nearly 2,000 years ago. You follow the words of a man that were written down after his death by men who did not know him in a language you cannot speak. Words pass from mouth to ear how many times, pass through how many languages, subject to the whims of how many men's tongues and pens. You cast yourself out onto the sea and cling to that wreckage, the misheard and mangled words of your crucified God, corrupted over centuries to the point where they are no more credible than barroom hearsay, backyard gossip, and you believe that those words will save your soul. I call that madness. I when I read that, it was like, wow. I mean, this guy is kind of, you know, he's a designed to be a lunatic, and he certainly committed some terrible, heinous murders, but he sort of makes a whole lot of sense, especially after reading the Da Vinci Code and discussing with you my thoughts on that very subject. He encapsulates it so well, this idea that the religion of Christianity is founded hundreds of years after Jesus had passed away, and the stories that were relayed about Jesus were passed down from generation to generation. There had to have been stories that changed. There had to have been, translation errors. And so I felt that was a passage out of the Truth of All Things that really resonated with me, and I thought that you might find interesting, especially given the discussion we had on the Da Vinci Code. So that was the Truth of All Things. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the events of this past weekend. The LA Times Festival of Books was this past weekend, this past Saturday and Sunday, and as my wife and I and our daughters do every year, we went one of the days down to USA to walk around. And I really get energized when I'm down there, because you see so many people who are just in love with books. They're in love with the writing process. They're in love with everything about the storytelling, whether it be fiction or nonfiction. You see self-publishers, you see people out there who are standing out in the hot sun all day for two straight days with the hope that they can sell a book or two, a book that they wrote, that they self-published, that they want to get the word out, and they want to share with the public, even if it's just one or two people. And I found that if you go to some of the booths where it's the self-publishing, that the people who are not the authors that you're really, that are noteworthy yet, you find that they'll talk to you for a long time. They will spend lots of time with you, because they understand that if they invest the time with you, you will invest the time in reading their books. And isn't that what a writer does, but wants people to read? I find it's interesting, because I do this podcast and I don't really expect anybody to listen to it. And I know that there are a few people who do, but I don't really do it for the feedback. I don't really do it because I expect somebody to comment on it or tell me I'm wrong or even tell me that they liked it or tell me they agreed with it. I don't really do it for that purpose. But writers, I've always wondered, actually, maybe I got to take it back a step. I've always wondered why people write, because it isn't an immediate feedback. If you're a stand-up comic, I guess that's where you get the immediate feedback. If you're an actor who does stage productions, you get the immediate feedback. But if you're a movie star, if you're a writer, if you are a singer, and a singer who is recording on, a CD, not necessarily a singer who's performing on stage, but a singer from that standpoint, you're not getting the immediate feedback. And so maybe I always thought that the writer writes so people would read, but maybe there are writers out there who write and don't particularly care if anybody reads it. Maybe it's just an outlet for their art. But if that's true, I don't know that those are the people who are attending the Festival of Books, because people who are there at the Festival of Books are doing so because they want to meet readers. They want people to read what they have. and it may be strictly monetary, although I can't imagine that this is a this is an industry, the writing industry, where you get into it because you have this great expectation of making a lot of money. I'm always astounded at how many books there are out there. You think about somebody like a David Baldacci or a John Grisham, who seemingly can write a number one bestseller in their sleep. And that's not, by the way, to downplay the significance of the books and the art of the storytelling and the amount of work it takes to craft a book like that. But, you know, it's like from Swingers, where the main character is talking to Lorraine and she says, "Oh, you're a comic." And he says, "Yeah, I came out from New York." They made it sound like they were handing out sitcoms to comics at the airport. Well, it kind of has that perception. You know, you write a book, you'll have a bestseller. And I'm always astounded at the number of people who write books that never sell books, or who write series of books, you know, 5, 10, 15 books, and it's not until their 17th book where they get some level of notoriety. And so to interact with these people to the limited extent that I had the opportunity to at the Festival of Books, it's really it's an energizing experience, because I want to get all the books and I want to read them all and I want to finish the book I'm reading so I can start the next one. And I really felt a kinship to the people who are there, because I have this great love of reading. I have this great love of the craft of writing. Even though I don't have particularly great skills at writing myself, I do have an affinity for the writing process. And so coming back from the Festival Books, I always feel this new level of energy. On top of that, I had a chance to see a couple people who I had not seen in a while, people not only who I would like to say I'm friends with, but also people who I'm fans of. People like Todd Goldberg, who happens to also be a fraternity brother of mine, but who I've recently developed a bit of a fan-ness to. Had an opportunity to read a couple of his books. One was a novel, one was a collection of short stories. And I've also listened to Todd's podcast called Literary Disco that he hosts with two other people, Ryder Strong and Julia Pistel, which I really, really enjoy. It comes out every 2 weeks. And that was, by the way, one of the inspirations for me to create this podcast, because I wanted an opportunity to talk back to the radio. And also, they didn't always discuss the books that I wanted to hear, but I still listen anyways because I enjoy the interplay between them. And you learn something new, even if it's another damn podcast about poets or something like that. But I got a chance to see Todd. Todd is a fraternity brother of mine at Cal State Northridge. He and I went to the same school. And he was in the fraternity and graduated by the time I came to the fraternity, although Todd did spend a lot of time around the fraternity house, so I did get to see him a lot. And you learn a lot about somebody when you read them. I didn't know Todd very well, seen him around the house, knew he had a great sense of humor, and was known as a bit of a jokester, but I didn't know a lot about his acumen for writing. And I had heard that at some point he had sold a book. I think MTV Publishing had purchased his first book and had published it, but I didn't know much more after that and hadn't really investigated it. So when I heard about the podcast, Facebook is an amazing thing because you get to see so much about people. And I had friended Todd on Facebook and saw it. He'd started the podcast. That interaction with his personality led me to want to read some of his writings. So a couple months ago, I picked up one of his books called Living Dead Girl. And if I was hoping for the comedy, the humor, the personality of a Todd Goldberg, I didn't get it in that book. I got darkness. I got depression. I got the darkest pieces of the human psyche. And it was really unnerving. I mean, you feel like you know somebody, or you have a perception of how they're going to be. You think that their writing is going to be a reflection of that. And this book just caught me completely off guard. And don't get me wrong, I really, really enjoyed it. But, I mean, it was dark. It was creepy. It was scary at points. It was unnerving. And I've talked about it before, this idea of the unreliable narrator, and that was exactly what you had in this book. And I don't want to go too much into the story, the details of it, but the general plot is this guy comes back from Los Angeles back up to a home that he and his estranged wife shared up in Washington State. And he's going back to the house because it's a cabin on a lake. He's going back up to the cabin because his estranged wife, they're not divorced, has gone missing. And so from there, you get the whole gamut of the human psyche of this guy as he's narrating. I mean, it's a first-person account. And so you're only being told the information that he wants to provide you. But at the same time, you have to have this, sense in the back of your head that he's not telling you everything. And so from that standpoint, I thought it was really a fascinating literary undertaking to create a first-person account with an unreliable narrator who, for lack of a better terminology, he's deceived himself. Not necessarily that he's schizophrenic, although there may have been those tendencies, but he has deceived himself into believing that he is person A when in fact he's person B. And I'm not going to tell you what A or B is, but it really was an unnerving experience to go through the real tearing down of this guy, because you saw it from his perspective. It wasn't the third person account. It wasn't the fly on the wall. It was him discussing it for you and expressing all of these things. So you didn't really have a good comfort level that you were being told everything, but you were also really, really made uncomfortable by the revelations that he was uncovering as the story progressed. So I really enjoyed it from that standpoint, and from it being much more literary than I expected from Todd. Not that I expected him to be, untalented. I always knew he was talented, but I was expecting a little bit more of the jokey and comedic Todd Goldberg. And so after I finished the book, I emailed him and I told him I finished it and that I was unnerved by it. And, what happened to the Todd I know, who's, funny and swears and a jokester, and to which no topic is really off base. And he mentioned that he likes to explore these things. And whereas I always figure that the writer writes what he knows, this was actually a situation where Todd went to a place where he didn't know and saw where it went and took it as far as it would go. And I really thought that was a fascinating concept. Not one that I think that I could undertake on my own, but I thought that was really a fascinating conceit that Todd undertook. So I'm looking forward to more. Todd also writes in the Burn Notice series books that are based on the television show Burn Notice. I haven't read any of those, but I'm told from Todd that they're a little bit more light. They have a lot more humor, a lot more action, a lot more sex, I think. So I might pick one up, but I'm not really familiar with Burn Notice characters at all. But I got to see Todd on Saturday, so that's a long way to come back. I got to see him on Saturday at one of the booths, and he was gracious as ever, and it was really nice to see him. And like I said, I've become somewhat of a fan, and what you want to be able to do as you come to these things like the Festival of Books is you want to see these people who write about your heroes. You want to be able to interact with the people who bring you a lot of enjoyment and entertainment. Because when you think about it, reading a book is not something you can do over a period of, a half-hour sitcom or two-hour movie. It really does require an investment of your time. And these people who put the words on paper, they invest a lot of their time into it also. And so you feel that there's a common bond that you develop with the author, because the author's written it down and you're taking the time to ingest it. And to be able to see people who you are fans of, it's a rewarding experience. And I can understand why there are people who go to the book fair and take, suitcases worth of books with them, hoping that they'll get, an autograph of somebody that they are a fan of. I've done it a couple of years ago, or maybe last year. I brought a couple of Michael Connelly books with me so that I could have him autograph it. In that type of situation, you don't really get an opportunity to sit and schmooze, because he's got a long line of other people he's got to sign for. But still, to be able to make that connection with somebody who has provided you with so many hours of enjoyment and entertainment, that it's rewarding. And to be able to sit with Todd for a minute or two and just say, you know, I really enjoyed your books and I like your podcast and, you know, it's nice to see you. It's enjoyable. The other person I got to see, who is also, I would say, a friend, is Les Klinger. And Les is somebody who I, by a weird series of coincidences, got to meet. A few years ago, I was going through the bookstore. I was at the Barnes & Noble in Woodland Hills, which unfortunately has since closed. And I saw that there was an annotated Dracula that had come out. And it was this beautiful hardbound edition of the book Dracula, but it had annotations. So it had footnotes and it had explanatory essays and things like that. I had never read Dracula before. And I was a bit intimidated by it because I felt that it was going to be dark. I was worried it might be scary, but I also thought it might be dry. So I figured that I would read it in this annotated fashion. And I loved it. I think I did myself, again, a little bit of a disservice because I should have read the book, the novel first, and then read the annotations, because as you read the book, if you stop each time there's a footnote, you lose the flow of the book itself. And you start to become more engaged in the descriptions in the footnotes than you do the actual content of the book itself. But I enjoyed reading the book as part of the annotated version. And by a weird coincidence, I was having lunch with somebody who I met through a networking group. And we were talking about our respective law firms, and he told me about his law firm, and he mentioned the name of his law firm, and he said that his law partner was Les Klinger. And I said, well, that's strange, because I know a Leslie Klinger who had written this annotated Dracula. And he said, oh, yeah, it's the same person. I was floored. I mean, it was just so weird. The coincidence of it was just so strange. And I said, can I meet him? And the guy said, yeah, absolutely, no problem. And he says, by the way, not only has he written this Dracula book, but he also happens to be one of the foremost experts on the Sherlock Holmes canon. And before he had done the Dracula annotated version, he had done all of the Sherlock Holmes annotated versions, which are, I think, four wonderfully bound hardback versions of the Sherlock Holmes books with annotations. Same essays and explanatory footnotes and things like that. So I read by that point the first volume of the Sherlock Holmes books, and had also read the annotated Dracula, that this seemed like truly a wonderful opportunity to meet him. So this gentleman, the partner, introduced me, and Les and I went to lunch. And I can't tell you how exciting that was to be able to sit down with somebody who you've read their work, you are a fan of their work, you are impressed by their work, you are overwhelmed by the amount of work that it took to do the two annotations, and to basically be able for 2 hours to over lunch discuss all of that, and discuss it from the standpoint of a literature fan, not an attorney. This wasn't networking. This was literature. And I just loved it. And I've stayed in touch with Les over the past few years. He and I are Facebook friends again. And I've run into him now the past 2 or 3 years at the Festival of Books. And I haven't seen him since then. I haven't seen him since last year. But I saw where he was, walked over, and it was a handshake. Rob, it's so great to see you. How's everything going? He remembered my daughters. He remembered my wife from last year. And, you know, look, we're all individuals. People are people. But when you have developed a fan-ness for somebody and you hold them on a bit of a pedestal, and I'm not worship type thing, but you look at them as somebody who's accomplished something that you really are excited about or you're impressed with, and you hold them on this pedestal of really having accomplished something, when they interact with you as a contemporary, it's really it's warming. It's heartwarming. It really makes you feel good. And so to get to see Les even for the couple minutes and find out what he's working on next. I know he's working on annotated H.P. Lovecraft works, and I think that's science fiction. I'm not much into science fiction, I know that he also worked on an annotated Sandman. I'm not sure too much about that, but again, I think it's more science fiction or maybe even horror, which is not something I'm particularly enamored with. But again, just to go shake a hand, get a smile, you know, get the feeling that Les is seeing somebody who he's, you know, a familiar face to him was, you know, it made the day worth it. And so I enjoyed it from that standpoint. So, you know, Todd and Les, if you guys are listening, you know, thanks. It makes the whole reading experience rewarding to read your works and to then be able to engage you on what I would call a friend level, not just a writer-reader or a writer and fan level, to be able to interact with you on a friend level. It really makes the reading experience that much more personal to me, and so I especially enjoyed it. As far as the books that I got at the book at the Festival Books, I only got one. It actually was a book that was recommended to me by Les. It happened to be the author who was sitting next to him at one of the booths. I don't remember her name. I think it was Terry something. And it's her first novel. I'm looking forward to reading it. It takes place in Los Angeles, and it's a police officer, police procedural. And when I asked her who her inspirations were for writing the book, or what author she looked to as inspiration, she mentioned two of my favorites, Michael Connelly and Robert Crais. So can't go wrong if an author's also a fan of those books. She also mentioned that she was a fan of the Joseph Wamba books, the police procedurals. I actually read one of them. I think it was called Hollywood Station a few years ago, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to this one. So we'll see how it goes from there. After I had read The Truth of All Things and it was time to get back to reading, I decided I wanted to read something pretty basic. Because in going back over the books I've read this year, and I set a goal, I think, of 60 books to read by the end of the year. And I've read maybe 20 or 25. I have to say that on the whole, I've been pretty disappointed by them. I've read a lot of books about a lot of books by authors that I hadn't read before. And so after I'd finished The Truth of All Things, and that was yet another book in a row, let's see, going backwards. 1, 2, 3, I'll take the Sun Also Rises out. 4, 5, 6, 7. I'd read 7 books in a row by authors that I'd never read before. And I just needed something comforting. I needed to go back to an author that I knew. I needed to go back to a character that I was comfortable with. I needed to get out of the rut of taking a flyer on a new book. Because that's what this is. It's a roll of the dice. You don't know what you're going to get. You might get something fantastic, or you might discover an author you are now enamored with and can't wait to read more of. Or you may discover an author that you just didn't quite get. And I wanted a reading experience that was going to be predictable. So I went to my bookshelf where I keep all of the to-be-read books, and I was trying to find what that book would be, and I didn't succeed. There was a Ted Bell book, which I had picked up, and it was the second book in the Alexander Hawk series. And I read the first book called Hawk. That was the first book I finished this year, and I really enjoyed it, but I didn't feel like I was ready for the second book yet. I didn't feel like I was so enamored with the character that I was comfortable enough with it to start that book again, to start a second book. So I couldn't find a book. I really struggled. And a couple weeks ago, or maybe last month, I saw on a daily deal for Kindle that there was a book by Joe Nesbo called The Devil's Star, I think is what it was called. And I had heard about Joe Nesbo before. I didn't know a whole lot about him. And so I thought, okay, I'll give it a shot. I'll start reading that book. But as I was looking at the book and trying to get a little bit more information about it, I learned that it was like the third, fourth, or I think it's the fifth book in a series of books involving one character. And I don't particularly like starting a book, starting a series in the middle. If there's a series of books, I want to start from the beginning. Now, Joe Nesbø is, I think, a Scandinavian author. And after the Stieg Larsson books came out, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the two sequels, there was like an onslaught of books from Scandinavian authors, these mysteries. And I think Joe Nesbø was one of them. I think Henning Mankell was another, and I'm sure that there were more. And so these are books that have been translated from the original. I think Joe Nesbø books are Norwegian because the books take place in Oslo, Norway. So I think they were translated from Norwegian. So in reading the Stieg Larsson books, which I loved, and I read them, I like to say, I read them before they were popular. I read them all in hardcover. I picked them up the first day that they all came out and burned through them. But they were real. There was some meat to them. It wasn't just a throwaway paperback. I mean, it was something you really had to spend the time with. So I was a little bit wary about starting another series of books that were from, you know, Scandinavian, not knowing a whole lot about the character, not knowing a whole lot about the genre that they were in. I was a little bit reticent about doing it, starting the book, especially given the fact that I'd had such bad luck lately in starting, you know, in reading books by new authors or authors that were new to me. But I didn't want to start The Devil Star because that was the fifth book in the series. So I went to the book that was as early as I could get. Because interestingly enough, two of the books, the first two books in the series, have not been translated yet into English. I don't understand why. Makes no sense to me, but whatever. I think this is the third book in the series, and it's called The Red Breast. And the main character is a guy by the name of Harry Hole, I think. The way it's spelled is H-O-L-E, and I, you know what, I can't bring myself to call the guy Harry Hole, and I can't imagine that that's the way it's supposed to be said. I think I went onto Wikipedia, and I looked it up, and I think it's pronounced Hooley. So when I see it in the book, I have to really remind myself not to call him Harry Hole, because then it would just distract me. But I don't want to give too much away about the book. It's 600 pages. And I'm reading it on the Kindle. And as I mentioned in the past, I'm always wary about reading a book on my Kindle because I feel like I'm missing something. And the book is 600 pages. The Dragon Tattoo books were 500 pages long, at least, 550. And they felt like 550-page books. You had to really work to get through them. They were difficult from the standpoint of the street names and the locations and even some of the characters. But even still, they were fairly complex books. So I was a little bit nervous that a 600-page book, also translated from, you know, Scandinavia, would also be that level of complexity. It hasn't been, so that's why I feel like I'm missing something with the Kindle. Actually, the book pages are just flying by. I mean, it is. I'm really, really enjoying the book. I really enjoy the character. It feels a little bit like the character I read in the Ian Rankin book, and the character name is escaping me right now, but I'll mention it when I finish this book and talk about it next time. But I read the first book in that series called Knots and Crosses, and I didn't really enjoy it that much. But the character seems to be very similar to Harry Hole in this book, The Red Breast. But one of the things that I'm really enjoying about the book is it's bringing together two aspects of literature that I happen to enjoy, the murder mystery and World War II. Now, this World War II involvement has to do with Norwegian soldiers who, I believe, defected to fight with the Germans. I think Norway was an allied country, but these Norwegian soldiers went to fight with the Germans. So it really is a mystery that spans, you know, a couple of generations. And I really, really enjoy it. The pages are just flying by. I feel like I'm making a whole lot of progress page-wise, but the story is moving along. And I just can't wait to finish it. I can't wait to finish it. And then I might just go on to the second book right after. I still don't know why they haven't translated the first two books first. It doesn't make any sense to me. But, I can't wait to talk about that one with you. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, The Great Gatsby. I read The Great Gatsby last year, and I didn't particularly like it. But I went to the movies last weekend, and I saw a preview for The Great Gatsby, the movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio. And the movie makes the book look... let's go back. The movie looks like it's going to be pretty good. It looks like it's exciting. It looks like it's engaging. It looks like it's got a strong story. And those are all things that I didn't find in the book. There are, from the preview, it seems that they have dramatized quite a bit of Gatsby's backstory that does not figure into the book itself. If I recall correctly, certain descriptions of Gatsby's antics and exploits are told either in flashback over the course of a couple paragraphs or are just spoken by Gatsby himself. So to actually see dramatizations of Gatsby in the war or Gatsby, on a shipwreck or whatever it was, I don't remember. That's what makes the movie look exciting. And that's what bothers me. It doesn't bother me from the standpoint of whether it will be a good movie or not. But one of the things that I understood about The Great Gatsby is it's following and its significance as a piece of literature is based on the encapsulation of the 1920s jazz age. And The Great Gatsby, to me, is it's a snapshot of time. It's a snapshot of that time and that era. And it's a novel about the jazz age. And it's not a novel so much about the characters themselves. Sure, you've got the character of Gatsby, and you've got the character of Daisy, and you've got the character of the you've got the characters of the other couple and what happens to them and how the romance between Daisy and Gatsby tears apart numerous families or numerous couples or whatever it is. But in reading the book the way I did, to me, it just didn't seem like it was character driven. It's not a story to me. It's not a caricature of people. And well, maybe it is. It's a caricature of a society of people. So I don't know how that would translate onto the screen. And by the previews, it doesn't look like it does. By the previews, it looks like it takes the characters and magnifies their importance in the framework of the novel itself. Because I don't recall the characters being as important as the age itself, the era, the time, the jazz age. So I'm curious to see the movie, to see if it takes out all the dry descriptions and all the slow-moving portrayals of that age. It takes all those out and raises up the story of the characters and makes the story much more character-driven instead of, socially driven. And if that's what it does, I'm really kind of curious to see what happens. What happens in the literature world? Whether literary scholars and devotees of the book are going to castigate the movie because it flip-flops it. It turns it inside out. It takes the potent aspect of the book, the descriptions of the age, and it minimizes those in favor of exposition about the characters. So I'm interested in seeing the reviews, but I'm interested in seeing the reviews not from the movie going public. I'm interested in seeing the reviews from the literary public. And maybe at that point I'll have to reread the Great Gatsby again, because I when I read it, I felt like I missed something. I really did. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be getting out of it. And similar to The Sun Also Rises, I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be getting out of it. To me, these both of those books were literary fiction that was not plot-driven. They were literary fiction that was more a snapshot in time, but wasn't being pushed along by character development towards a denouement, towards a resolution, towards a revealing. And you can't have a movie that way, because it'd be a pretty damn boring movie. And so to me, what it seemed like from the trailer, they have magnified the characters in order to create that drama, because otherwise it would be a boring movie. So anyways, that's that. So this has been episode 8 of Book Therapy. I'm Rob Cohen. I gave you all the details of how to find me earlier on. Oh, and one other thing. I'm taking it quick. To those of you who are on Goodreads, when I finished Defending Jacob a couple podcasts back, and I was really convinced that the narrator, this unreliable narrator, had done the murder himself. And I went on to Goodreads and I looked at the people who had posted discussions about the book. And I raised my questions about, is it possible that this is what happened, that Andy was the culprit? You know, some of those people on Goodreads were downright nasty, telling me that I was wrong. And it made me feel back in eighth grade or ninth grade, whatever it was, with the Cask of Amontillado, where I was being told I was wrong. You know what? I'm not wrong. This is my perception of it. And to the one person who came to my rescue, and interestingly enough, it was somebody I went to high school with, the one person who came to my rescue, thank you. I'm not wrong. I just have a different interpretation. And you know what? Sometimes a therapy session needs to end with anger. And so this is my frustration. To those of you who delight in telling people they're wrong, you're wrong. That's all. You're wrong. You can't tell people they're wrong. I'm not wrong. That's just my interpretation. And just let me have it. So there. Thank you for letting me lie on your couch.